you need to make sure that what you have online 100% complements, amplifies, adds on to what you are going to be saying in that interview room. If it contradicts what you say in the interview room, then it's almost like you're toast, to be honest. So it's absolutely essential for you to evaluate how you appear online.
Let's go!
Hello and welcome to the Brand New You Show, the podcast dedicated to helping you build your brand. We meet here each week to learn how building your brand can help you grow your influence, amplify your online reputation, and ultimately impact your career. I'm your host, Ryan Roten, and today's guest wants to take you from good to ideal job candidate. Melissa Larina is president of Career Outcomes Matter. At Career Outcomes Matter, Melissa and her staff coach top executives how to strategically dissect and deliver the perfect job interview. Melissa is an employee transition expert, an interview specialist, career coach, and a blogger. Her articles have been featured in Forbes, The Wall Street Journal, and The Huffington Post, just to name a few. She is the author of the ebooks The Mommy Shift, A Reentry Strategy, The Guide for Landing a Global Assignment, and the ebook we will discuss today, How to Get Back in the Driver's Seat, Become the Strongest Job Candidate. Melissa, it is my pleasure to welcome you to the Brand New You Show.
Thank you, Ryan, for such a lovely introduction. I'm really excited here to be speaking with your guest.
I'm excited to have you on today, and we are going to dive right in with the very first question I ask every one of my guests, which is, if you could vacation in only one place, where would you go?
Top of mind, Croatia. But with zero children. I have three little boys. So for me, a vacation means no kids. Having been from New York, a town called Astoria in Queens, New York, I was amongst a lot of Croatian peers in my elementary school days. And so I never had a chance to get there. And at this point, I would love to make my way.
So let's go ahead and dive into your career. And my first question for you is, how did careers become your career?
Started a while back. So for instance, back in 97, I was about 17 years old. I do not encourage you to do the math. But back then, I actually earned a full ride to NYU, sponsored by the bank Chase. And Chase, back then, now JP Morgan Chase, they used to offer so many professional development programs as part of this internship scholarship program that I was a part of. And so I was always privy to workshops on how to write your resume, how to interview more effectively. And I was always surrounded by these top level executives in this Fortune 500 organization. So as a result of that, just voluntarily, I would share with my peers on how to present themselves in a corporate setting, how to position themselves on paper and in person. And that started out for free, as with, you know, many of our passions. And so when I went ahead and I was encouraging so many people at that young age, I decided to just keep that thread along my career. So I transitioned and I started actually marketing products and services. So I would, you know, one of my clients was IBM, for example. Another one was Charmin, the toilet paper brand. And so for me, I just started gathering more and more insights and tools and awareness as to the way that the big brands position themselves and market themselves, you know, from key messages to the way they advertise and all these great things about them. And what I started to do is just incorporate all those learnings and all the great leaders with whom I've worked into the way that I coached my friends. And that was up until business school. I went to Tuck, which is in New Hampshire in Dartmouth. And so I earned my MBA at that point. And that was around 2008. And I was noticing so many exceptional professionals being just really downtrodden because of the limited jobs that existed back then. And so even at that stage, as a student, I decided to, again, coach my peers and really help get them through that really, really complicated financial crisis moment. There were a lot of folks, for instance, that wanted to go into investment banking. Folks wanted to be consultants, and the jobs were just few and far in between. So having gone through that crisis and having learned everything that I did throughout my time working for different corporations, I decided once I graduated business school to take this idea of coaching professionals, these really high-performing corporate Olympians is what I call them, and built a career out of it. And so I incorporated my business in 2011, and I decided to then figure out how to make a very fulfilling living out of marketing people instead of products and services like I had in the past.
I would imagine you were probably able to leverage some of your contacts as you were going through school to find that first paying client, correct?
Well, ironically enough, my very first client wasn't through school. It was through my first job in advertising. And so it was someone that reported to me. Her now husband was looking to land a job in the United States, and he didn't have a visa and he didn't have his MBA, but he wanted to go into investment banking. So that was the trend early on for me, investment bankers and financial services, because I'm based in the New York area. But I would say my peers, they certainly served as great case studies to help me build out my business. So originally, when I was doing this for free, I definitely then shared those case studies with my prospective clients.
All the people that you've coached and worked with now over the last few years since you've started your business, what do you find to be the most challenging part of being a career coach?
So I would say the most challenging part about being a career coach is that you want to really provide this exceptional high touch service, but I have few hours in my day in which to do that. So it's difficult to just time manage, especially when I have children at the stage that they're in. So that's been my personal struggle, I would say. But at the end of the day, it forces me to do things even more optimized. So what do I mean by that? You know, whereas I can scale up someone's interviewing skills over the course of 5 weeks, let's say, because of my own time constraints, I've figured out a way to do it in 36 hours.
Oh, wow. If you could wave a magic wand and there was one thing that you could change or that you wished that all of your customers knew before they came to you, what would it be?
I give homework.
Okay.
That would be number one. So at the end of the day, even though some clients have asked me, they said, "Hey, Melissa, can you actually go in there and do my job interview?" At the end of the day, it's really about what you put into the process. So for example, I can try my very best and really get out from you your greatest professional wins. We can together go through the best way to position a gap on your resume. We can do all sorts of things as it relates to your professional history. But at the end of the day, if you're not willing to actually sit down and do some heavy lifting, then it's not going to be as helpful. I mean, you have to, on command almost, go into that interview room and just be able to produce results. You're there to have not just interview conversation, but it's a business conversation, rich business conversations. People want to know that you're going to solve their business challenges. And if you don't know every single challenge they have, you need to do that on an impromptu sort of basis. What that means is that you need to be exceptionally prepared and comfortable with what you're bringing to the table. And the only way to be prepared and comfortable is if you dug in, you know, if you're the one that did the homework and you're the one that actually practiced and put in the effort.
Talk about preparing for an interview, and you have, in exchange for an email on your website, a very detailed, and I think probably one of the better ones that I've seen, guide on how to prepare for an interview. It's called How to Get Back in the Driver's Seat, Become the Strongest Job Candidate. And anytime somebody writes an ebook like this, the first question I like to ask the author is, who did you write the book for?
Well, when I was looking at my audience, because I didn't write this ebook early on in my business, it was a little later on. When I was looking at my audience, what I was noticing is that basically, I was helping people that were senior in their careers. So let's say, you know, 15 years plus of real work experience. These were people that own profit and loss statements, people that were people leader. And then there was also this thread across their interests. And the thread was really about being competitive, ultra competitive. There was a certain masculine tone to the way that they presented themselves. And so for me, you know, just thinking about someone that's strong, thinking about someone that, again, is a corporate Olympian, it made sense to me to have something that would speak to their needs. And so it's someone that's not going to be satisfied with what Google provides in terms of, you know, interview answers or sample answers. It's someone that really wants to go the distance, so to speak, in order to better prepare themselves than anyone else in the same interview waiting room. And so I wrote it for that person, someone really competitive. It could have been, you know, a marathoner. It could have been someone that climbed Mount Kilimanjaro, someone that's just has these very high expectations and quite honestly tends to exceed their own expectations.
I love that term, corporate Olympian, by the way. I think it's very clever and very descriptive of the type of people that you work with. And I'm curious, from a mindset standpoint, it sounds like a lot of the folks that you coach or you work with, they're higher senior level executives. They're people who were probably doing the interviewing before they came to you. How do they adjust? How do they make that adjustment? Or what do you think the biggest challenge is for them to adjust from being the person who's asking the questions to now becoming the person who's on the other side of the desk needing to answer the questions?
I would say a part of that is this element of control. So for example, I've coached folks that are going into the CFO role quite frequently, and other C-level suite opportunities as well. And so basically, you know, where they've always been the one to kind of select the talent, come up with the questions, be able to even make the decisions at the end, and of course, have those salary negotiation conversations. People like this, you know, they've always been in control of the room. You know, they've been in control of the order of events. They've been in control of what they ask, they don't ask, what they probe more deeply into. And so when you're kind of on the other side of the table and you have to be the one kind of being evaluated, you're the one being judged, etc., you have to change your perspective a bit. So while you still have some sense of control, you can still choose to answer or not answer questions in certain ways. At the end of the day, it's that respect that you're giving the interviewer, and also the fact that, you know, you have to really explain yourself. Okay. So it's not so much prove yourself, because the way that you prove yourself, again, is in solving those business challenges during the interview conversation round, but, you know, really express yourself and explain yourself. So explaining yourself might be a little uncomfortable if you've always been a decision maker, because people have come to you and they've explained their ideas to you. But in this setting, you have to be open to unpacking your greatest wins. And so the hardest part for them is letting go of that control and just being a little bit more deliberate in the way that you explain what made that big win so big. Why was it a game-changing decision on your part?
I would imagine another thing other than just giving up that control is that over the last few years, there really is a quote unquote new interview process that exists. So, and this happens to be one of the chapters in your ebook. Can you explain how is the new interview process different than, say, the old interview process?
So in terms of the new interview process, I'd say that at this stage, things are happening a lot more quickly. Although as a job candidate, you might not feel that way, but let me really explain what I mean by that. So for example, in the past, you know, you would go submit your application and, you know, someone either calls you or doesn't call you. And then you just kind of keep doing that until something, you know, works out for you. And then you'll go into an interview and they ask you fairly run-of-the-mill questions with the hiring manager and the human resources person at most. It's pretty much, you know, conversation after conversation with these people. Maybe you talk to someone that would be your direct hire. Today, it's different. People know a lot more about you these days. So, you know, aside from doing an online search on you, they also have a really great sense of your wins, because if these are very high-level people, chances are these wins were in the media. And at the same time, you know, they have a good sense of your weaknesses as well. So the other thing I would say is that, you know, now you're not just meeting with one person, two people. Now the investment to hire one person is just so high that people have to really bring in almost like a whole team to really analyze whether you're the right fit, whether you're going to accomplish what they need to accomplish within their time frame. What that means is that now you're not just talking to an HR person, a hiring manager, but you're also talking to your potential cross-functional partners. Now you have organizations that are just so big that they're very matrix, lots of layers, lots of functions, lots of interface. So because the stakes are high, because the information is just out there, because you have so many people that are part of this process, you actually have to go into your first round interview a lot more prepared than in the past, because they've already gotten through the, you know, U 101 portion. Now they're in like the U 201 portion. So they really need to understand a lot more than just, you know, what you've been doing for the past 15 years. They need to understand how what you've been doing for the past 15 years very specifically maps out into how you can help them do what they need to do in the next, let's lower the time frame to 2 years, 5 years, etc. So it's a lot more of an analytical conversation, rich business conversation, a lot less of, you know, memorization. This is my job history, and these are the skills that I have. And it's a lot more people making a decision. So you have to impress a number of people. And at the end of the day, they all have to convene and come up with one decision on you. So it's a bit of a, it's very complex today.
Mentioned that nowadays they know you better, and that know you better part actually happens before you even get into the building today. Why is it so important to have this squeaky clean online and offline persona today, especially for executives?
Sure, Ryan. And this taps into your brand as well, right? As far as presenting yourself as a thought leader. So I would say it's really important because, you know, they will, HR managers, even people that are going to interview you, they are going to do a Google search on you. People are Google searching, you know, all sorts of things these days just to have a better grasp of who they'll be meeting with. So really, you need to do a bit of an audit before you're even in the market for a job, because different people are going to have different impressions of what they see online. You know, it's fair to have your interests out there. It's fair to have your professional accomplishments out there. But the big, big takeaway is that you need to make sure that what you have online 100% complements, amplifies, adds on to what you are going to be saying in that interview room. If it contradicts what you say in the interview room, then it's almost like you're toast, to be honest. So it's absolutely essential for you to evaluate how you appear online.
Yeah, so it's not only important to make sure that there's congruency, if you will, between your resume and your online personality just to get to the interview point, but then you also need to make sure as a candidate that what you say from your answers also aligns. Is that correct?
That is correct. That is correct. And so, you know, the onus is really on the interviewer. You own your brand and you need to be very mindful of the way that it's being expressed across various touch points. And that goes beyond LinkedIn. It goes beyond your Facebook page. It goes beyond, you know, your Instagram account. It goes beyond what you control and own. So again, that's why you need to do a simple Google search on yourself to see what other people are saying about you as well.
So invariably, we've made sure that our online profile is congruent with our marketing documents, our resume, and everything else. And we get into the interview, and this happens in every interview. We often are asked at the end of each individual interview, do we have any questions? Is it ever okay to not ask any questions?
If you don't want the job, then yes.
So it's that important in the interview stage to make sure that you're asking questions of the hiring managers.
Well, let me put it this way. If in business, what really matters is asking the right question in order to solve any business challenge, then you need to step up your game and start asking the right questions during an interview setting. Otherwise, what is it that you're proving? It's really about being exceptionally prepared. For instance, I was coaching someone that worked for an organization, and it wasn't that she was going to work for another organization. She was an internal job candidate. Even she, who worked in the organization for plenty of years had questions during that interview. So if you're an external candidate, then you should definitely bring about some questions. It's essential.
In your ebook, you have 5 questions that you recommend people ask at this particular stage. So why is it important for you as a candidate for a position to ask the hiring manager how the job you're applying for actually contributes to the department goals?
Well, at the end of the day, what you want to do is you want to make the hiring manager's life easier. So having a better understanding of what he or she perceived the goals to be is really helpful at the onset of any job. So if this conversation is not happening at the job interview stage, it should at least happen during the onboarding stage if you're hired. It's essential to just get a really good understanding from the perspective of the person that is actually measuring whether or not you achieve this goal, what they think the goal is, right? So it's really important to have a sense of what that person perceives the goal to be. I would add to that to then say, if you ask this question, what you're doing is basically having a conversation about what's on their mind. You know, what are the goals that they have to hit? You're also opening up the door to be able to say, okay, well, this is your goal. Perhaps this is how I've, you know, achieved or exceeded a very similar goal under similar circumstances in my professional past. So it's almost like you're putting a little bit of a bait there and you want them to really take advantage of it.
Okay. Why is it important then to also at the same time, once you know the goals, to understand what the ideal candidate's qualities are to be successful in that position?
Well, a lot of my interviewers that I help, basically, they say things like, you know, is there anything that concerns you about my professional history or something negative in that way? So is there anything that I'm lacking? Is there anything that, you know, you're concerned about as it relates to what I bring to the table? Instead of asking those negative questions, it's better to reframe and basically ask in a more positive tone what the qualities would be of this ideal person. Once the hiring manager tells you the quality, so let's say they say, you know, someone that is culturally fluid. So someone that can work in China, or they can work in South Korea, or they can work in Argentina. And let's say you don't have that. Let's say you don't have that in your repertoire. Then that gives you an opportunity, ideally a good opportunity, to then share ways that you've come close to working with folks in other countries. So it's just a way to turn around what could be perceived negative to something positive. Does that make sense, Ryan?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, all these questions, and we won't go through all 5 of them, but I do recommend people go put in their email address and download this book. It's really good. But all of them seem to me, they have kind of 2 purposes. One is to get a feel for the position and where the hiring manager's kind of thinking is for what the position is going to do. But then they also give you the opportunity to explain how your past experiences can help solve those hiring manager problems.
Exactly. So the whole idea is when you are asking questions, you're not just asking questions for the sake of it. You are still selling yourself.
Now, you also include in the book, and again, we're talking about your ebook, How to Get Back in the Driver's Seat, Become the Strongest Job Candidate. You include 5 questions that potential hiring managers could ask. And we won't go through all 5, but there's one question that you list that I personally hate this question, but if it's true, as Peter Drucker once said, that a person can only perform from strength and one cannot build performance on weaknesses, what is an interviewer looking for anytime they ask a candidate, what is your greatest weakness?
To keep it simple, I would say they're looking for someone that is self-aware. Organizations these days need very self-aware business leaders, because once you have this self-awareness about you, once you know your strengths and your weaknesses, once you are also honest about your strengths and your weaknesses, then you can go about putting together a team that can basically, you know, address those weaknesses, or basically, I'm just going to use the term outsource those weaknesses, but essentially someone that can help you get through that, right? And then continue to exceed on whatever goal it is that you've been given. So they're looking for self-awareness. Sometimes it's also a stress test. So if someone asks you this, you know, you don't want to be all flustered. You definitely want to be very composed, and you want to have a good sense of who you are and what you bring to the table. Some of the best answers that I've heard have always been very honest. And so I would suggest thinking about the most honest answer to that question that exhibits how you have worked through that weakness.
Another question that you have here that hiring managers will ask, and I have been asked this one before as well, is how do you handle the question, why are you the best person for the job?
That has to do with the homework that you did before going into that interview room, for sure. At the end of the day, what you want to do is have a good understanding of their SWOT. So the company's strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. So you want to have a good idea of what's going on for this company as it relates to the role that you would be taking on. And then what you want to do is basically figure out whether you're able to amplify that strength because of your previous experiences, whatever the strength might be. If you're able to mitigate a particular threat because of a particular leadership quality that you have, a relationship that you have, et cetera. So it's a deep analysis. And Ryan, I'm glad you asked that question because it's actually a product that I'm going to be launching in the near future. So it's really related to just how much due diligence you did on the company, and then figuring out in what ways you absolutely complement the company's needs.
And I think one of the ways that you talk about in your ebook is that people can use the winning benchmarking matrix. Can you tell me just a little bit about what that is?
Sure. So that's something that I put together because I worked at one point in competitive intelligence when I worked at Chase. And so again, what I do, just thinking about, you know, all the tools that I have, is I take business tools and I use them for someone's career efforts, basically. So it's a competitive analysis exercise in this matrix. And essentially what I want you to do is think about the people that would be in the interview waiting room with you and see how you compare, contrast to what they bring to the table. So very simply, if they have an MBA, for example, and you do not, is there something about you that overcompensates for that, you know, academic experience? If they have a CPA and you do not, same thing. Is there something in terms of your classical accounting training that overcompensates for someone that has the designation of a CPA? So it's an Excel tool that I came up with, and I actually shared with a number of guidance counselors in universities across the U.S., and they were very impressed because essentially what it does is it reverse engineers, you know, what it takes for you to get a job. So it's definitely something that my most analytical clients have enjoyed thoroughly.
I want to dive into your section of the book called The 90-Day Plan. And in the very first paragraph for this one, you talk about how it's important to let the interviewing manager, him or her, know what you will do in your first 90 days on the job. So who is the plan for? Is it for you or is it for the employer?
The plan is for both, right? So what does that mean? So it's for you, because what it's going to do is it's going to force you to think through how you're going to A, scale up your skills, your know-how of the company, your know-how of the sector if you're a career changer. And it's also going to put you in a position where you'll have a good sense of how you would intend to take on this new role if they hired you. So technically, and what I've seen people do is they'll even use this actual 90-day plan when they're eventually hired as well. So it's useful from that perspective, assuming that you really want to work at that organization, right? The other side, in terms of the employer, so, you know, recruiting someone is very costly. So what I've noticed in terms of the new interview process, not only is this recruitment that's going on, but also customer focus groups, let's call it that. And what that means is that interviewers today are trying to extract as much value as humanly possible from every interview and interviewer. So if you're giving them this 90-day plan and they happen to see things that they like, whether you're hired or you're not, Yeah, they will then consider, you know, implementing some of these ideas. Granted, you're not going to be providing some proprietary breakout ideas in this plan because you're not yet employed, but still it's directional and it also gives the employer a sense of, wow, I can imagine this interviewer in the role. I can imagine that they're going to be this thoughtful once they get the job and I actually give them the real goals that they need to go after. So it's a two-way street. The plan is for you because it'll also secure in your mind that you actually are capable of doing this job. So it's a confidence boost. And then for the employer. So again, they might use it as a data point saying, wow, Ryan came with a 90-day plan. No one else in that interview room came with a 90-day plan. So let me give Ryan an extra look.
So is this plan something, it sounds like you create it before you go into the interview room based on your research of the company versus you're kind of using a framework and formulating this plan in your head. Is that correct?
Exactly. And I've seen it play out in two ways. So there's definitely some functions, for example, if you're a salesperson, then I'm going to give you the authority and the okay to say this as a conversation and have this be more conversational in terms of the 90-day plan. If you are, however, someone in supply chain, someone that's a little bit more analytical, more, you know, in written format, then I would encourage you to have an actual physical document to bring with you into an interview room. On the other hand, if you had the interview and you didn't have a chance to share your 90-day plan, but you want to increase your odds of getting that second callback, then I would even put it as a nice little follow-up with the thank you note.
What are some things that go into the plan itself? Like as I'm doing my research for the company, what are things that I want to make sure that I'm paying attention to or looking for as I read through all, you know, and conduct all my different research to make sure that I get it into the plan?
So, I mean, the first thing that you would want to look at is the job description. I mean, that almost serves as a skeleton for the way that you need to organize your own plan. So in my 90-day plan blueprint, what you want to do is just think about the job thematically, right? So, you know, one theme might be, okay, you as a leader. And so let's say you have 5 direct reports. So what do you intend to do with those direct reports during your first 30 days? You as someone that needs to get to know the organization. Okay, so, you know, how do you intend to talk to all of these cross-functional players and influencers and someone in finance during your first 90 days or 60 days? So it's really organizing your thinking around how you intend to, A, you know, really get familiar what needs to get done in an organization, and then B, set yourself to the path of actually accomplishing and executing what you've learned. So the plan is essentially, you know, mapped out during that time frame, because that time frame tends to be, I'm not saying for the most senior leaders, but it tends to be almost like the probationary period, right? It's like when they're trying to figure you out. So what you want to do is when you're networking, as you're interviewing, you're asking these specific questions. You're asking, what are the goals of the organization? What are the goals of this particular business unit? What do you know about this manager very specifically? That's if you have that much access to the company's people. You know, if you don't, then it's literally looking on different platforms. It could be something as simple as Glassdoor. What are people saying about the organization? Oh, okay. Or it could be looking at industry magazines. So you need to, for yourself, look at the job description. From there, think to yourself, okay, I'm responsible for people. I'm responsible for the money. I'm responsible for whatever, process improvements. Okay, so you chunk that out. And how can I accomplish those things within the first 30, 60, 90 days?
So as we move forward, let's assume we've been following the ebook, we've asked the right questions, we've been able to show that we're self-aware, we've got a 90-day plan. The next thing, the next kind of phase would be, okay, we get through the interview process, and then, you know, if we've done it all of our homework correctly, and we've impressed everybody, we're going to get an offer. And one of the things that makes people really, really nervous is if they want to ask for more money when the offer presents itself. How do you recommend people handle those situations if they feel the offer is too low, or maybe it doesn't hit where they feel that they need to be based on the value they bring?
Well, the first thing you want to do is, you know, position yourself in your mind first, right? So have a number, have a number in your mind that you really want to hit. Have a bit of a range in terms of, you know, what you're willing to consider and entertain. Once you have that number, once you have that range, what you want to do in terms of salary negotiation, you need to take the emotions out of it. You need to also really think to yourself, okay, if I were a product or service and I had approved my return on investment, you know, how is it that I would then explain, you know, that by them giving me a salary that I want, I'm going to give them, you know, 10 times a return based on my efforts. Again, 90-day plan is really helpful when you're already showing them the path that you'd go on in order to give them that return. But then at the same time, you know, writing it out, listing it out, all the ways that you imagine, and you can use that word, I imagine, I envision, given what I know. For example, leading 5 people, if my budget, you know, responsibilities are going to be a $10 million budget, if I have to meet this particular goal, you know, if I'm going to be contributing X in revenue, if that's my responsibility, then it makes sense based on what I know, you know, averages are in the industry, based on the people that I've spoken with, based on, you know, what I know about your organization. It makes sense for me to have a $250,000, you know, total compensation package, for example. So it has to be analytical, numerical. It has to be grounded in previous, you know, results that you've brought about for former employers. And then you have to have that conversation with your prospective employer on their terms based on their goals. So there's a lot of comparing and contrasting. So it's about the scope of responsibilities that you have. It's about really nailing number by number. Okay, this many people, this is how much money I want, but this is what I think I can deliver. And by the way, here's my 90-day plan, so you could see how I intend to start thinking about that.
It sounds like you are recommending that people put a lot of time and effort into preparing for the interview, like the preparation part was your job. So how important is it as you're preparing for the interview, not just the gathering of the data and understanding the job and all that stuff, but also to practice interviewing with a partner?
It's essential. It's essential because at that point, let's say you've done all this preparation. Let's say you've spoken to yourself, looked at yourself in the mirror. And let's say that you've written out your sample answers. Let's say you've done all this analysis privately. You still need to gauge, you know, ideally from an objective third party. So not a partner, because partners, they know you so well. If you miss something in terms of your career history, chances are they won't ask you because they already know it. So it's almost like you're filling it in. They're filling it in as they're mock interviewing you. But definitely try to get a third party that is objective, you know, ideally someone like myself or me, and, you know, really, you know, have them ask you questions that you don't expect. If you notice that one interview question, what is your weakness? I found 20 alternatives. Okay. That means that there are at least 20 more that I could probably come up with if I just sat down and thought about it. You need to be prepared for things that come from left field. You need to also really, you know, stretch yourself, okay? So when you are, for instance, you know, writing something down, sometimes we have typos in our writing. Sometimes we don't notice them because we autofill. Same thing with the mock interview. If you're mock interviewing yourself, you might not catch some of the points that really, really matter. And so having that practice moment, when you're going after a senior level, so I'm speaking director level and above, there's no alternative. You have to have a mock interview. And I would encourage you to have a mock interview with someone that's had the job in an ideal world. That would be ideal. Someone that's had the job would be amazing. But, you know, life is so busy that I'm sure those are hard to come by for an hour mock interview, which is why the third party is best.
For those who are interested and would like to learn more about you, your services, and of course, download a copy of this book, what are the best ways for them to get in touch with you?
Simply just go on my website first. So melissalarena.com. Go on my website or look me up, Career Outcomes Matter. What I would prefer is that you have a sense of my tone, a sense of the way that I work, a sense of the fact that I'm very direct and very specific in my guidance before we have a conversation. And that would be the second step. Then actually schedule a call. And you could do that directly from my website. So we can have a conversation that's focused on you and where you are in your job hunt. And then from there, you know, we could definitely discuss what the best next step is and how I can help you. Because, you know, knowing where I come from first and kind of how I approach different job search challenges is just helpful because it's not for everyone. Like you mentioned, Ryan, I have homework and I expect a lot from my clients. And so it's helpful to just be aware of that first.
Awesome. Melissa, any final thoughts, tips, or advice that you would like to pass on to anyone that's listening today?
Well, I mean, in terms of just preparing for the job search, I would say that, as I mentioned earlier, you know, it's really not about your static professional history anymore. It's really a more dynamic, business-rich conversation when you get into that interview room. So I suggest that you do more than you've probably ever done in the past in order to best position you for any job in a Fortune 500 organization. And so it's best to also figure out for yourself, you know, if you're willing to go that extra step, then it actually is worth pursuing that job. If you're not, then that can also be a clue to you that you might not even want to go after that job in the first place. So I encourage you to, you know, honestly just evaluate how committed you are to a particular opportunity. And if you're very committed, then I'm the right person for you. And in terms of just the 90-day plan, which I think is a really great way to express A, how committed you are, and B, whether you can do the job and prove it to an employer, you can buy that right from my website. Just go to the shop page on melissalarena.com.
Awesome. Melissa, I appreciate you taking time out of your day to speak with us. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ryan. Have a great rest of your day.
Abraham Lincoln once said, "Give me 6 hours to chop down a tree, and I'll spend the first four sharpening the axe." Preparing for the job interview is exactly the same as sharpening the axe. Like Honest Abe, Melissa understands that the success of any task is in the preparation. You need to prepare for the job interview as if the preparation itself was, in fact, your job. And because the preparation requires so much effort, if the role excites you, you will want to dive in and do the research necessary to develop the 90-day plan. On the other hand, if the thought of creating a 90-day plan for any particular role feels like drudgery to you, then maybe you're looking at the wrong role. So if you want a new position, take the time to sharpen the axe because that's how you prepare for the job interview. Thank you, Melissa, for your time today, and thank you, the listener, for tuning in. You can find all today's show notes over on the blog at ryanroten.com/Melissa Larena. I'm going to close out today's show with just a quick announcement. Today marks the 114th episode of the Brand New You Show. For 85 weeks in a row now, I've had the privilege to speak with many guests and share their insights and wisdom with you. I don't know about you, but I personally have enjoyed each and every one of them, and I have learned a ton of things along the way. During that same time frame, I haven't missed a single week, and that includes when I moved from Indiana to Denver. And while I'm very proud of that, I am announcing today that Season 1 of the Brand New You Show will come to a close at the end of August 2016. But don't worry, borrowing the lyrics from the band Semisonic and their song Closing Time, every new beginning comes from some other beginning's end. Which is why I'm happy to tell you that Season 2 is already in the works. And I can also tell you that with Season 2, there will be a slight pivot in the content, as well as a possible rebranding to align with the new direction. I will explain my reasoning for this pivot, what the new season will be about, and when you can expect Season 2 to launch during Season 1's final episode, which will be coming up in 2 weeks. So until then, I've been Ryan, and I'm out. This week's show was edited and produced by Ryan Roten. The transition music is Vulcan Fiesta by Borderica, and the intro and outro music, as always, is Pulse by Soundrove.